Turn in your Bibles to Genesis 29. We're going to be looking at verses 1 through 30. This is a very familiar story to most people. This is the story of Jacob, Rachel, and Leah. You are mostly familiar with the idea that Jacob is swindled in this story. He ends up with two wives at the end of it. As we have said over and over again, as we've seen the life of Jacob, two women, one man, bad idea. So let's read together before we dive in any further and see what the Lord has for us here. Then Jacob went on his journey and came to the land of the people of the east. As he looked, he saw a well in a field, and behold, three flocks of sheep lying beside it. For out of that well, the flocks were watered. The stone on the well's mouth was large, and when all the flocks were gathered there, the shepherds would roll the stone from the mouth of the well and water the sheep, and put the stone back in its place over the mouth of the well. Jacob said to them, "My brothers, where do you come from?" They said, "We are from Haran." And he said to them, "Do you know Laban, the son of Nahor?" And they said, "We know him." He said to them, "Is it well with him?" And they said, "It is well. And see, Rachel, his daughter, is coming with the sheep." He said, "Behold, it is still high day. It is not time for the livestock to be gathered together. Water the sheep and go pasture them." But they said, "We cannot until all the flocks are gathered together and the stone is rolled away from the mouth of the well. Then we water the sheep." While he was still speaking with them, Rachel came with her father's sheep, for she was a shepherdess. And now as soon as Jacob saw Rachel, the daughter of Laban, his mother's brother, and the sheep of Laban, his mother's brother, Jacob came near and rolled the stone from the well's mouth and watered the flock of Laban, his mother's brother. Then Jacob kissed Rachel and wept aloud. And Jacob told Rachel that he was her father's kinsman and that he was Rebekah's son. And she ran and told her father. As soon as Laban heard the news about Jacob, his sister's son, he ran to meet him and embraced him and kissed him and brought to him all to his house. And Jacob told Laban all these things. And Laban said to him, "Surely you are my bone and my flesh." And he stayed with him a month. Then Laban said to Jacob, "Because you are my kinsman, should you therefore serve me for nothing? Tell me, what shall your wages be?" Now Laban had two daughters. The name of the older was Leah, and the name of the younger was Rachel. Leah's eyes were weak, but Rachel was beautiful in form and appearance. Jacob loved Rachel, and he said, "I will serve you 7 years for your younger daughter, Rachel." Laban said, "It is better that I give her to you than that I should give her to any other man. Stay with me." So Jacob served 7 years for Rachel, and it seemed to him but a few days because of the love he had for her. Then Jacob said to Laban, "Give me my wife that I may go into her, for my time is completed." So Laban gathered together all the people of the place and made a big feast. But in the evening, he took his daughter Leah and brought her to Jacob, and he went into her. Laban gave his female servant Zilpah to his daughter Leah to be her servant. And in the morning, behold, it was Leah. And Jacob said to Laban, "What is this you have done to me? Did I not serve with you? Did I not serve with you for Rachel? Why then have you deceived me?" Laban said, "It is not so done in our country to give the younger before the firstborn. Complete the week of this one, and we'll give you the other one also in return for serving me another 7 years. Jacob did so, completed her week, and then Laban gave his daughter Rachel to be his wife. Laban gave his female servant Bilhah to his daughter Rachel to be her servant. So Jacob went in to Rachel also, and he loved Rachel more than Leah and served Laban for another 7 years. All right. Weird story. First read through. Did you notice what was missing? Did anybody notice what was missing?
God is not mentioned once.
God is not mentioned one time. God's not mentioned one time. She has an advantage over the rest of you in that she lives in my house and I talk about what I'm going to preach. So God is not mentioned once. He's not, his name isn't there. He's not praised. He's not exalted. Nothing. You would think that Jacob would have thought about the Lord at some point in a 7 year period. 7 year and 1 month, if we're going to be strict. Yet, God is not mentioned once. Just let that rest in the back of your mind. We're going to come back to that fact here in a minute. Suffice to say, when the Bible does not mention the main character, you ought to pay really, really close attention to that main character. Because he's always present. Remember, the Bible is not a story about a people group or about you or about me or about Israel or about anybody else. The Bible is the story about God and his actions engaging a sinful world. So where the Bible is silent, where God does not speak in chapters of the Bible, we must pay very close attention to what is being communicated. So this story echoes a previous story. As much of what we've seen of Jacob's life, this story echoes a previous story found in chapter 24, when Abraham goes to find a wife for Isaac. Abraham sends his servant to Laban, to Nahor, to find a wife for Isaac, and his servant goes. I'm just going to briefly tell you some of these things. The servant goes, and going to find a wife, he takes 10 camels, showing wealth and bringing the dowry offering. So he goes prepared to offer kind of collateral to prove, like, Abraham has enough to pay for his son to have a wife. This is, you're not marrying into a poor family. This is a good strategic marriage. So he brings the camels. The servant of Abraham goes. He takes wealth. He arrives prayerfully. The first thing the servant of Abraham does when he's searching for a wife for Isaac is he walks in. He comes to a place and he prays, "Lord, show me. Show me." He doesn't go try to do it himself. He doesn't try to work it on his own. He's not trying to do everything himself. He shows up. He says, "Lord, show me who it is." He gives him a test that he's going to ask this specific question of the woman, that she'll draw him water. He arrives at the well prayerfully. He purposes to find a wife for Isaac. He's got a purpose and a mission. And he waits and listens for the Lord to lead. So the servant of Abraham in chapter 24 goes to the appropriate place with the appropriate gift, in the appropriate perspective, understanding that this is a God thing and he needs God's guidance. And he understands the appropriate measure of the woman. The servant then stays and watches Rebecca to see if she is a woman of character before taking her, before going to make the exchange and bringing her to Isaac. So, this story, did you see all the contrasts? They are myriad, right? So let's look at Jacob's journey first. Note there's no mention of God in his journey there. We're going to look at this in two parts, verses 1 through 14 and then verses 15 through 30. So first, there's no mention of God or prayer or purpose here. Jacob went on his journey and he came to the land of the east, and as he looked, he saw a well in a field, and behold, three flocks of sheep lying beside it. For for out of the well the flocks were watered. The stone on the well's mouth was large, and when the flocks were gathered together there, the shepherds would together roll the stone from the mouth of the well and water the sheep, and then put the stone back over its place in the mouth of the well. So Jacob kind of stumbles into this place. He's just kind of bumbling along in life, and he walks into this place. This isn't planned. There's no purpose here. He's just walking along. Note, he's also by himself. He has nothing to give. He's wandering alone. And he walks up. He's got no purpose. There's no prayer. There's no statement or recognition of God. He almost stumbles into the land. Look at what he says. My brothers, where do you come from? We are from Haran. He doesn't even know where he is. Just walking along. Most people would at least have some idea of where they are. But Jacob comes across a well and goes, hey, where am I? And they go, we're in Haran. This is a city. There's structures. He's around where people live. He just came from Luz, right, which he renames Bethel, house of God, right? So he just came from one city area. Like, this is not, he's not out in Matagorda County. There's nothing. It's not out there. He's in places like Brazoria, where there's one stoplight, but you still know it's a town. Like, there's still a Buc-ee's here, at least, right? So there's two of them, and the first one's here. Is that right? The first one's here. So, yay! So he doesn't even know where he is. He feels like it feels like he's in exile. Like he's been kicked out of the garden. He's been kicked out of the garden, and now he's walking in the wilderness trying to figure out how to cultivate the earth. He's in exile from the blessing and the promise of God. Remember, he got the blessing, he got the birthright, and now he doesn't get either. He got them with his own hands. He stole them with his own hands. And now he loses both. And he's walking in the wilderness hoping to secure something. He doesn't know where he is. This speaks to the ineptitude of Jacob. Like, he's a brilliant deceiver, but he's inept at living life. He's brilliant at deceiving people, but he can't live life. This is a guy that can't hold a job. He's just kind of inept. So in verse 7, look down at verse 7 when he says, behold, it is still high day. So the shepherds, this is a hysterical part of the story. The shepherds see Rachel coming, and he goes, hey, it's the middle of the day. It's still high day. You're not supposed to be gathering the sheep for nighttime. So why don't you guys water your sheep and get out of here so I can put the moves on this one. That's what he's doing. She's cute, so why don't you guys get out of here? I have some deception to work out here to make her want me. That's what he's doing. He tells them to get out and go ahead, leave. He reveals his shallow nature. Remember, contrast this with Abraham's servant who waited to observe Rebecca. So he sees her and he tries to eliminate the competition. That's what he does. All these other shepherds are around. He's like, hey, you guys, don't you guys need to take a walk? Get on out of here so I can get this woman. Then in verse 10 and 11, jump down to verse 10 and 11. See, now as soon as Jacob saw Rachel, whenever the Bible talks about sight, it's important, especially when it's followed by something with the mouth. So he sees Rachel, and then he kisses her in verse 11 and weeps aloud. Remember the way God determined things were good in Genesis chapter 1? God creates a tree. He sees it's good, says it's good, and it's good. Things are good because God sees them as good and says they're good. They are not good apart from his declaration and apart from his sight and approval. God is the one who determines good, not the other way around. So when Adam and Eve fell, do you remember what happens? The The snake points to the fruit. Eve sees the fruit. Is a delight to the eye and would be good to the taste. So she takes it and eats, declaring that as good, declaring what God has called evil good. So here, Jacob, no mention of seeking the Lord's will, sees Rachel and he's going to kiss her, declaring that he knows what is good apart from God's guidance. That he knows what is good apart from God's guidance. And just look at this. So women in the room, put yourself in Rachel's shoes. You're taking your sheep to be, I know none of you own sheep, but you're taking your sheep to be watered. You're doing your job. It's the middle of the day. And this random guy sees you, rolls away the stone, serves you by watering your sheep, and then runs over to you, kisses you, and cries aloud. And says, I'm your cousin. This just got awkward, right? Like, this is weird. Even in the Middle East, just so you're aware, even in the Middle East, this is weird. You identify yourself. You wait a while before you give the holy kiss of greeting. It's not, you don't do that right away, and you certainly don't weep aloud. Right? So Jacob is a man here who is awkwardly passionate to the point of revealing his shallow nature. He is so awkwardly passionate that he reveals his true shallow nature, that he is proclaiming his love for this woman already at first sight. And then here, we see he rolls the stone away. Jacob came near in verse 10. Jacob came near and rolled the stone away from the well's mouth. Now, this stone was put there as a contract agreement between all the shepherds. They didn't remove the stone until all of them had gathered. This provided them, ensured that everybody got enough water, that all their sheep would be taken care of. So not all the sheep are gathered yet, and they're waiting for the rest of the flocks to come so they can move the stone. Now, implied there is that this stone is heavy and that you needed more than one guy to move it. Look at what Jacob does. He moves it himself. This ought to key in your brain. Stone being moved by one guy when it needed to be moved by multiple guys. Oh, God is present. God is present. He's there. Jacob, trying to show his own power and his own strength, runs and removes the well, removes the stone from the well. Ha ha! Showing off for the girl. That's what he's doing. He's showing off to get the girl. Moves the stone. Now, I remember when I was in high school doing similar things. The difference between me and Jacob is I wasn't trying to move a stone. I was usually trying to do something much less impressive, like the moonwalk. All of you have stories like that. Except for Kitty. So the stone, he moves the stone out of the way and then runs to her. And this is this passionate, loving response, and then he meets Laban. As soon as Laban heard the news about Jacob, his sister's son, he ran to him and embraced him and kissed him and brought him to his house. This ought to key in your brain. Uh-oh. Jacob is the same as Laban. And we know Jacob. We also know Laban from chapter 24, by the way. He's a swindler and a cheat. We already know that. He's greedy. We already know that. We see that with Abraham because he's only concerned about Abraham's wealth. And so we know this about Laban already. But here again in the story, you're reminded Laban's almost exactly like Jacob. So they run and they meet, and Jacob meets his doppelganger. And Laban stands. Now, lenses in the Bible are very important. Lenses are extremely important. Lenses help you see things the right way or the wrong way. We could take this story of Jacob getting two wives and ending up in, we could moralize it and say, here's a set of rules that we're supposed to follow. We do that. That's one lens to look through this story in. We could focus on Jacob as we have done for the first 14 verses here, and we could say that obviously Jacob is the big deal here, and we could focus on all of his errors and all of his flaws. We'll find a lot of sympathy, a lot of things we agree with as we've read through these 14 verses. Have you not felt like in some ways you relate to Jacob? Yeah, I mean, a little bit. At the same time, we distance ourselves by recognizing he's a rat. I'm not a rat. He's a rat, right? And we recognize that he's kind of like a junior high boy in this story, you know? Yet, lenses are important. So I want to go back and I want to look at this story with the right lens of providence. So just, now you've heard the story, we've gone through it, we've read it once, we've talked through it once, let's look at it again. Jacob, at the very beginning of this story, stumbles on a well. On a well. As he's walking, he doesn't know where. And he stumbles onto a well. Not only does he stumble onto a well, but it's the middle of the day when nobody's supposed to be there. And he finds people there. Not just anybody, but people. Shepherds. Who know the land and know the layout and know who people are. He finds people there. This is insanely providential. God seems to direct his bumbling steps to the well. Stumbles on the well, a place of refreshment that is shared by all, but veiled by a stone. He stumbles onto a well, that is a place of refreshment that is veiled by a stone, but shared by all. Gee, sounds an awful lot like when we find the gospel, doesn't it? We stumble onto the well of life. It is veiled by the stone of sin and is evenly shared by all who will come to it. Jacob stumbles into this grace of God. Stumbles into this grace of God. The stone draws our minds back to the previous chapter where Jacob set up a stone to remember the Lord. He set up a stone. He poured oil on it and anointed it and called, "This is Bethel, the house of God." In the previous chapter, he sets up this stone to commemorate the Lord. And what's the first thing he finds here? A stone. He stumbles onto it. He stumbles upon the gathering at the wrong time of day. It's the right gathering at the right time, providentially designed for him to find his way. Providentially, Rachel walks up as he is talking to the other shepherds. Providentially, God covers Rachel's presence, protecting her by having other people around. So there's no slander or chance of impropriety. Providentially, the shepherds say, "No, we're not going anywhere. You want to mack on her? Fine, but we're right here." And they can all see. So there's no impropriety. You see, in the midst of our own ignorantly silent behavior towards God, God continues to provide. Even when we fail to acknowledge or seek His will or seek His aim, God continues to walk ahead and providentially provide for Jacob. He does the same for us. We often are in Jacob's shoes and try to make things happen by our own sheer force of will. Like Jacob, we often try to remove the stone and show ourselves to be incredibly mighty and powerful and strong. And sometimes God lets us move the stone. And when that happens without the acknowledgement of God, without the recognition that it's God's power that enables us to have victory over anything, we need to be very careful, because what comes next is never good. God exalts God's name because God is supremely worthy. When we are exalted, we must start to tread very lightly and turn, repent, and pay close attention to God. When God does not speak in a passage or in our life, we must be very careful. We are like Jacob, beholden to providence even when we don't recognize it. Lenses are important. And we must see this lens through the lens, we must see this story through the lens of God's providence. God has provided for Jacob to stumble on here, and he has provided for Jacob to meet his match in Laban. So we move to the next section of the story here in verses 15 through 30. And Laban then says to Jacob, because you're my kinsman, should you therefore serve me for nothing? So he offers him wages, which is only fair. It's only fitting. He's serving him. He's been there for a month. Laban sees that he's a hard worker. He's going to keep him. He's a guy that needs to prove himself. So Laban knows, I can work this guy. I can work this guy. He's got some insecurities I can play on to get him to do what I want him to do. And so Laban then prepares. And here we see a story in which, just as in the previous two chapters ago, Isaac, a blind man, was deceived in the dark by his two sons switching places. So this time, Jacob is going to be deceived in the dark by two daughters switching places. This time, the agent is not Jacob's mother who comes up with the plan, but Jacob's uncle comes up with the plan. And he's going to come back to bite him. So just as two sons were switched before a blind man, two daughters are now switched by a man in darkness. The application I think we can draw here is, when we don't set our minds and our hearts on the light of God, we are easily deceived. When we don't set our minds and our hearts on the light of God, we are easily deceived. Remember, there's a lens to see this, and that is the lens of providence of God in His silence. Jacob tries to secure his own righteousness here. So Laban says these things now in verse 16. Laban had two daughters. The name of the older was Leah, and then the younger was Rachel. Leah's eyes were weak. This is a very Hebrew polite way of saying she's not pretty. Rather homely is what this means. Her eyes were weak, meaning she did not look good in the eyes. So that means in your eyes, she didn't look good. She looked a little bit homely and not quite attractive. Whereas Rachel was beautiful in form. That's emphasized as well, because it's not talking about her character. Jacob has fallen in lust. He's fallen in lust. He thinks, for lack of a better term, he thinks she's sexy. That's it. There's no depth of relationship that's described here. There's no character that's described here. Jacob is in awe of the way this woman looks. And that's it. Unlike the servant of Abraham who sat and waited to see the character of Rebekah, Jacob here doesn't do that. He just works and thinks that this woman is very good looking. And that's his opinion of her. So, Jacob then here bucks the social norm of primogeniture. He says, Jacob loved Rachel, and he said, I'll serve you 7 years for your younger daughter, Rachel. And Laban said, it's better that I give her to you than I should give her to any man. Stay with me. So Jacob served 7 years. So here's the deal. Jacob says, I'll take Rachel after 7 years of service. And Laban goes, oh, awesome. Deal. You got it. 7 years of service. Okay, it'll be easy. We'll do this. Let's do it. And he says, cool. Now, here's the problem. In Laban's culture, which is Canaanite culture, not the Hebrew culture, in Laban's culture, firstborn women get sent off first. The firstborn baby girl gets given to a husband first, because she's firstborn. J- Jacob bucks that system yet again. Now, I want you to understand, he's not bucking the system of God. He's bucking societal norms. Society says, firstborn goes first. That's it. This isn't in the script, like, nowhere in the law does it say the firstborn girl has to go first. That's a cultural thing. This is not God's directive. This is society's directive. Laban is not following Yahweh. He's not following the Lord. He's doing what society tells him is best. So Jacob bucks the firstborn practice again. He did it with Esau. He did it with Leah. Now, there's a word of caution here. There's a right way to buck social norms and a wrong way. The right way is to trust in the Lord and obey Him and follow Him and have a massive amount of patience. Because God moves when God moves, not when we want Him to. He's not tame. The wrong way is what Jacob does. He tries to force it in his own hands. He makes a deal with Laban. I'll do this for this. I'll serve you 7 years for Rachel. He gets Leah. Things go bad. He has a rough time, a rough go of it. God redeems the situation. Don't get me wrong. God is a God of redemption. And even in the midst of our sin and wickedness, He redeems us. That's the message of Jesus Christ. You believe in Jesus Christ, you trust Him, you follow Him, He redeems you and saves you, not because you're good, not because you made the right choice, but because God is good and kind and loving and has rescued you out of your sin. That is the message of Christ. Jacob is a picture of us being redeemed by Christ in that we do not strive for goodness, do not strive for holiness, do not strive for righteousness until He has changed our hearts and altered who we are. And come to rescue us and redeem us from sin. Jacob here bucks against the social practice the wrong way, trying to steal his own righteousness. Then Jacob here in verse 21, Jacob said to Laban, give me my wife after he served her. It's gone by super fast because he's in love with her. He's very excited. He says, give me my wife and I might go into her. The time is completed. Again, he's very concerned. There's an emphasis here that Jacob is very concerned with physical relationship. I don't know how else to put that. The Hebrew is very concerned. He is very concerned with his physical relationship with Rachel. Much more concerned with his physical relationship than he is with her being his wife. There's a lesson for us men to be had here that marriage is not simply about a physical relationship. It's about much, much, much more. So, Jacob here, that's all I'm going to say about that in case you were wondering if it was going to get any more awkward for the guys. That's it. Jacob here comes to Laban. He gets his wife in dark. Laban swaps out the two brides. And this seems absurd, except when you consider that a festival in the Middle East of a wedding, there's a lot of alcohol. The bride wears a veil that covers her face, all the way through any ceremony, often all the way through any ceremony. And there's a lot of alcohol. Jacob is drunk. It's nighttime. It's dark. He's not paying attention. And a woman is placed before him and told, this is your wife. And they say, great, and they go into their tent. Yeah. He's drunk. And he wakes up in the morning, finds out what he's done, and goes, oh no. And he's enraged. I want to point out, he's not at all concerned for Leah. And that's gross. Leaps up, what have you done to me? You gave me the ugly one. That's what he tells him. And Laban says, well, look, man, it's our culture here. You can't just have, tell you what, serve me another 7 years. I'll give you Rachel too. No, you don't have to wait. Just finish the week. There's a week period. Like a honeymoon they're supposed to have. he and Leah. And so he's got this week. He's supposed to finish with Leah. And then I'll give you Rachel too. Then you'll get your week with her and 7 years more work. No big deal, man. Hey, then you get two wives. And Jacob now has to learn in the crucible of slavery to trust the Lord. So Jacob, in his attempt to earn his own righteousness, is taught by God here that he must learn dependence on the Lord. He still doesn't learn it, just to give you a heads up. He doesn't learn this story until, this doesn't really come to a point where he learns this all the way until chapter 30, the end of chapter 32, into chapter 33, and whether or not he gets it then is still questionable. So we got three chapters before we get to Jacob learning this lesson. But he needs to learn to depend on the Lord for his righteousness. So he stands before Laban here and works, and in the crucible of slavery, Jacob must prove himself to be of good character. He must prove himself to be of good character. And he's going to fail again. And again. And again. And again. And we need to remind ourselves that lenses are important. We can see this story as Jacob's failing, or we can see it as God's redemption. Jacob fails. God is going to take Jacob's sinful behavior, the sinful act of taking two women, really four, by the way, he ends up taking four, the sinful act of taking multiple women, the sinful act of trying to secure his own riches and his own wealth and his own power. God is going to take that, and from that sinful, wicked people is going to bring an offspring who is going to bless the nations of the world. From that sinful, wicked people, God is going to bring redemption. He's going to take our sin and our wickedness upon himself and rescue us in Jesus Christ. And all the nations of the world will look and say, "We are far too wicked for the holiness of this God." And God will say, "Yes, I know, but I have made a way for salvation." And indeed, he looks at you and you say, "Lord, I am Jacob. I am a liar and a deceiver. I have tried to secure righteousness on my own. I'm a good person, if there is such a thing. And yet I know when I look at myself in the mirror that I'm not good enough." And God responds with, "I will change you and make you good. You will go from being Jacob to being Israel. You are mine." So, in conclusion, we need to remind ourselves of the lens in this weird, weird story. We need to see God's love. He remains present in Jacob's wandering, so much so that he providentially designs for him to land at a well with a bunch of shepherds. He remains present in Jacob's slavery. He remains present, get this, he remains present in Leah and Rachel's affliction of being married to a swindler and a cheat. That's next week. He remains present for them because while Jacob doesn't seem to care about his wives, God does. God does. He remains present and providentially cares for the people whom he has called his own. Second, I want to remind you that your sin comes back to bite you. It does. Jacob swindles his dad by swapping firstborn with the youngest in the dark. Jacob gets swindled by his uncle who swaps the firstborn for the youngest in the dark. Your sin will come back to bite you. The only hope here is in the lens by which we view this life. So listen, our only hope in this life is the lens by which we view it. We either put ourselves in the middle and die trying to make ourselves righteous, or we put Christ in the middle and live in righteousness because He has made us alive. The lens by which we view life is important. The only hope is viewing this life through the lens of the gospel of Jesus Christ. You want to know how we solve the problems in this world? We teach people that they can't fix it on their own, that they need Jesus Christ's transforming power. Then He changes our hearts, and we become agents of righteousness and good on this earth. You want to know why every altruistic organization in our world ends up at some point being for profit? It's because the gospel is not centered in those. Find an organization where the gospel is in the middle, where Jesus Christ is in the middle of that organization, and you will find the only truly altruistic organization available that will serve people out of love. Indeed, that should be the church. Should be the church. Indeed, that's what we are striving to be.